This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Christopher Cruz in the Washington Bureau. Breaking news, it may not be a surprise, but it's still a shock. Donald Trump has been indicted on multiple federal counts.
CBS News confirms it's a 7-count indictment, charging the former president with unlawfully retaining documents related to the national defense and obstructing efforts to investigate how he handled those papers. The indictment is the culmination of a year-long Justice Department effort that had the FBI seizing 100 classified documents from Mar-a-Lago last August after Trump attorneys insisted he had no more in his possession. The former president is expected to appear in a Miami federal courtroom on Tuesday afternoon. Stephen Portnoy, CBS News, New York.
Trump posted a video tonight on his Truth Social website after he announced his own indictment.
So I just want to tell you, I'm an innocent man. I did nothing wrong. And we will fight this out just like we've been fighting for 7 years.
15 states from Vermont to South Carolina have issued air quality alerts.
Smoke from the Canadian wildfires made an undiplomatic stop in D.C., masking monuments, shuttering stadiums, and even forcing the pandas at the National Zoo inside.
And the air quality is bad outside. Staying indoors in well-ventilated places is beneficial.
With air quality in D.C. at hazardous, outdoor dining was taken off the menu. And it was indoor recess for area schools.
CBS's Christina Ruffini. The low visibility has caused delays at airports on the East Coast. FAA National Traffic Management Officer Sam Osby.
From the aviation standpoint, we slow things down and we allow aircraft to have more space to maneuver until they are able to safely see the airports.
The main suspect in the disappearance of American Natalie Holloway has landed in Alabama after being handed over to U.S. law enforcement agents in Peru. Joran Vandersloot is facing charges of extortion. Details from CBS's Janet Shamlian.
As part of an FBI sting, he accepted $25,000, and that is where these charges come from. He's never been charged with her death. However, he was arrested twice in Aruba. He was the last person to see her in 2005 after her high school graduation trip to that island.
It was another good day on Wall Street today. CBS's Jill Schlesinger says we could be looking at the beginning of a bull run.
The broad market indexes, like the S&P 500, have been led higher by a small group of what some are calling the mega cap tech stocks, the big, huge technology companies that took it on the chin last year and have led the way this year.
The number is at the close, the Dow up 0.5%, S&P 500 up 27 points, the NASDAQ up 1%. This is CBS News.
Hiring is a lot easier with Indeed. Their powerful platform makes it easy to attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Unthawed or thawed? These are the questions the Cripescast will cover every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and the Civic Media app. Can you just pull them brats out of the freezer? That'd be fantastic.
Here's what you need to know in Western Wisconsin. I'm Jimmy Kuska. A test well in the town of Campbell was free of PFAS contamination after recent testing. The town's drinking water has previously tested for unsafe levels of PFAS in La Crosse County. The test well was drilled below current wells, and an engineering firm said the cost to drill larger wells for the town to use would be about $500,000. The town plans to seek grants and work with the DNR to see if they can add a new, deeper well for its drinking water supply. Over a quarter of Wisconsin is experiencing drought, according to the USDA. That includes nearly all of Polk County and neighboring counties in northwestern Wisconsin and areas south of I-90 in southwestern Wisconsin. According to the National Drought Monitor, over 88% of Wisconsin is abnormally dry, while just over 25% is in moderate drought. The National Weather Service says that over the next 6 to 10 days, the state will see continued above average temperatures and below normal precipitation. For Civic Media News, I'm Jimmy Kuska.
The Todd Alba Show.
We'll be moving to the afternoon, Monday through Friday, 1 until 3. Trigvi Olsen has graciously agreed to follow us into the afternoon. We're going to get to talk about the Lincoln Project and politics in Wisconsin, all across the state of Wisconsin.
I know, isn't that exciting? Where the beer is cold, the cheese curds are squeaky, the Harleys roar, the Eagles soar, and the Packers score, Todd.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Ready for our little forest adventure?
Yes!
Yeah, I
want to
go outside, I
want to
be.
We're here.
Whoa, that was fast.
There's a forest closer than you think. Find a park or forest near you and music inspired by nature at discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by USDA Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Hey, son, how are you feeling?
I'm fine, Pops.
What's on your mind?
I can't explain it.
When your kid can't find the language, find the lyrics. Start a conversation at soundedouttogether.org. Brought to you by Ed Council and Pivotal Ventures.
It's What's on Tap for the Chippewa Valley. 93.5 The Tap.
Straight ahead from bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
It's the final batch of 180 million barrels from the nation's stockpile that the president last spring pledged to release over 6 months. Today, saying the reserve is still more than half full, but Republicans
say the reserve is half empty. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I'm sure your news is both half empty and half full. What do you have for us today?
Well, first up, in Nigeria, unusually intense seasonal rains have triggered the worst flooding in years, damaging homes, infrastructure, and vast swaths of farmland. The intense flooding has killed more than 600 people and displaced more than a million, aggravating food and fuel shortages in Africa's most populous nation. Extreme rainfall is directly linked to man-made global warming. Here in the U.S., in Florida, inland flooding is still receding weeks after Hurricane Ian. Officials now warn of a surge in infections of flesh-eating bacteria. Oh. The bacteria thrive in warm, brackish waters and can be deadly. 29 people have been infected in hard-hit counties so far. 4 have died.
It's just getting better and better down there, isn't it?
In other news, a new study finds that PFAS chemicals, a class of chemicals widely used in household and industrial products that are linked to kidney and liver disease and cancer, are likely polluting most U.S. waterways. The study found detectable levels of PFAS chemicals in 83% of waterways tested in the United States. The Biden EPA has begun the process of regulating PFAS chemicals.
Aren't those the same PFAS chemicals that are also found in everyone's bloodstream at this point?
Yes.
Not good.
President Biden on Wednesday announced the release of an additional 15 million barrels of oil from the nation's strategic petroleum reserve to lower rising gas prices that are driving inflation. Although gas prices have been falling and domestic oil production is returning to pre-pandemic levels, Saudi Arabia's OPEC Plus oil cartel recently voted to cut production to raise global oil prices, helping Russia to fund its brutal war on Ukraine. The Saudis' move is widely seen as a ploy to boost Republicans' chances in the November 8 midterm elections. If Republicans win control of Congress, they will slow down America's shift away from gas and oil. The midterms are hugely consequential for the future of climate policy and clean energy. While Democrats have passed the most significant climate legislation in U.S. history through the Inflation Reduction Act and last year's bipartisan infrastructure bill, Republicans at both the state and federal levels have vowed to dismantle climate policies, handcuff agencies, expand oil and gas drilling, and weaken pollution standards. Politico reports that state governors' races are critical for climate, particularly in swing states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and Arizona, where Democrats face Trump-endorsed Republican climate science deniers. It matters because state officials will control a significant chunk of infrastructure funding from the Democrats' landmark climate law, deciding how and where and if to deploy it.
Are they allowed to use it to drill for more oil?
They might just find a way to do that.
I bet they will.
But some good news. The Biden administration announced it will hold the first ever offshore wind lease sale for energy projects off the coast of California. Finally, some accountability news. The state of New Jersey this week became the latest to announce a lawsuit against five oil majors, including Exxon and BP and the American Petroleum Institute, for deceiving consumers about climate change in violation of state law. Multiple investigations have proven that the companies knew since the 1950s that burning their product would cause catastrophic climate change, and the companies chose to spend millions on a decades-long massive disinformation campaign to sow doubt about climate science. New Jersey Attorney General Matthew Platkin cited the rising costs of climate disasters and infrastructure damages, saying the oil industry, not taxpayers, should pay.
It's long overdue that these betrayals of their customers and of the public come to an end, and that the perpetrators of these lies pay for their conduct, and that the people of New Jersey receive restitution for all that they have lost.
Go New Jersey. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So we come to you from Ottumwa, Iowa. We're sitting here at the UAW Hall. And I want to thank the good folks here at the UAW for opening up their hall to us. And I want to thank the guy sitting across the table from me here today for putting out, just grabbing a bunch of people to talk to, the folks that you're going to hear today on the program. All the courtesy of Steve Singel. He is the guy here. He's the vice president of the South Central Iowa Federation of Labor, former Board of Supervisors member, AFSCME rep. He is the local labor guy. Steve, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you. Glad you're here.
Again, I want to just effusive with praise at the help that you've given us here. If we could Steve Singel things all across the country, it'd be such a better trip.
Well, I don't know about that, but I'm glad to hear it.
So, you know, we're in this moment, we're in this political environment, and, you know, we're here in Ottumwa, and this is such a beautiful little community. And, you know, as I've been traveling across Iowa and we've been talking to people, you get that small town feel virtually everywhere you go. And sadly, you know, I've had some people say, you know, our politics are tearing us apart. Do you agree with that?
Tearing us apart?
Yeah, you know, tearing communities apart, tearing families apart.
Oh, yeah, there's some of that. But I think mostly in Iowa, they're tearing the Democrats, unions, and liberals apart primarily.
And why is that?
Because we're not winning many elections. And the people who are not our friends.
And why isn't that message being told? Because, look, you know, I had a bunch of people who... You know, recently we've said, well, you know, Democrats just aren't looking out for our interests. There's this viewpoint that they're not fighting enough for them. But, you know, you listen to people talk about what Republicans are actually doing, and it's the antithesis of help. It's actually making things worse, but they seem to believe. So I'm curious, how do we make that transition backward?
I suppose we'll have to travel the same path in reverse. I don't really know. If I could figure it out, I'd be a genius, but
yeah, no, I see. I keep coming back to, you know, what you guys do here with the Labor Council. I keep coming back to what the members of this union are doing. It's about fighting for better wages, hours, conditions, about those kitchen table economic issues. You know, I say, you know, in my workplace 30 years ago, we dealt with the transgender issue. We had somebody who, you know, we'll call him Ron. Ron went away. Ron came back after a couple of months. Ron was Rana. Nobody cared. Now it seems to be the defining issue of who we are and what communities are tearing apart over. It just seems to me that if we take the time to move in a direction, and again, back to those kitchen table items, making opportunities for working people, education for our kids, safe neighborhoods, good schools, that seems to be the way forward.
Well, the one thing the Republicans consistently stand for is tax cuts. And I think people see that as something concrete in their hands that yeah, they like.
We hear this all the time.
The consequences of what that means.
Right.
Like in Iowa here, this last session, the legislature went to a flat tax. And over, they're going to go over the next 4 years, and they're going to give up 25% of their revenue. I'm like, what? How's that going to work? It's not. What they're going to do in 5 years is raise the sales tax, I think. But people, all I can see is, hey, I'm going to get save some taxes. As a retiree, I don't have to pay any income taxes and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but what's going to happen to our schools? What's going to happen to our services and our state parks? Well, they don't really, they'll be fine.
Well, they're going to privatize all that, which is what they're doing in all these other communities.
Oh, yeah.
All of these privatization schemes that you people then look back, oh, well, that was a bad idea, has just trickled down to Iowa a little bit late. And look, you're right. It's a bad idea across the board. Those flat taxes may sound appealing, but, you know, what it's really a giant handout to the wealthy. And I don't care how much you're making as a working person, you're not in that tax bracket.
No. Almost all the benefits will go to the top 1%. It's just outrageous. But people, you know, it's something people can hang their head on. What have the Democrats done for me? Now, I'm a lifelong hardcore union Democrat, but I don't support everything the Democrats have done, but I don't find too many Republicans that would do a better job, so I don't vote for them ever.
And I wish there were. No, honestly, you know, I remember back in the day, you know, there were pro-labor Republicans. There were Republicans
who would... Pennsylvania, you had some.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania, we had some. And, you know, really, you know, I have a friend who was a former Republican congressman, and he said, look, you know, when he was in Congress back in 2010, or 92 through 2006, there were 90 pro-labor Republicans in the United States House of Representatives who fought for prevailing wage laws to be included in bills, who protected collective bargaining rights. You'd have a really hard time finding more than two or three right now.
We don't have, well, actually, there was one guy in the Iowa legislature, one Republican, the last couple of years, he's been helpful to us, and the Iowa Fed endorsed him, and the Republicans took him out in a primary because of that.
Yeah. And this is where, as union members, and look, you, I've been talking to a lot of people here who say, you know, look, there are a lot of the union members who are Republicans for the reason that they make a good living. They make a really good living because their union negotiates that and they fought for it. But they have this view that they're going to save tax money. But, you know, I look at the last tax cut that came down during the Trump years. How many people saved really any money when you look at it in the broad scope of things, because they took a ton of deductions away from working class people. And I think it all came out in the wash for workers, but the folks at the very top, boy, did they line their pockets.
That's how it works. I wish we could somehow make our people see this, but so far many haven't.
And again, this comes back to education, doesn't it? I mean, it comes back to doing the hard work, and it comes back to these moments like being on the picket line. And I say it all the time, you know, back on election night of 2020, while the country was looking at who was going to be the next president, I was leading a strike of 55 warehouse workers, three quarters of whom voted for Trump that afternoon. But in that moment, on that picket line, they were all united. And that's an opportunity to begin having those conversations about,
it is.
Hey, how do we move forward? So in looking at, you know, the strike that John Deere just had, do you think that is going to help move the needle? Because, you know, we're talking to people who worked at John Deere who are now running for office, and you need to do that. Working people need to get back into the halls of power. Do you think that's going to help move this? Where do you see that playing in this community?
I think it will help some. I don't know that it will help enough. I mean, during the strike, I spent a lot of time there, and I think most Democratic elected officials around here appeared on the line. Raised money, brought gifts. No Republican people, legislators or elected officials or party people showed up at any of the Deere picket lines anywhere in Iowa. I tried to point that out to people, but I'd get in arguments. I didn't want to. It was their picket line, not mine, so I kind of backed off. But I hope so, but I'm not super optimistic Yeah, it's going to take more.
Because, you know, you look at what's happened to this state, and I'm just finding out all of the attacks that Republicans have levied against working people here recently. And again, the thing is all of the things that you're going through now, my state of Pennsylvania went through a decade ago. Or more. 96, they destroyed our unemployment. 96, they destroyed workers' comp. 2011, they destroyed unemployment. They actually had to go back and fix it because employers were begging them to fix it because it was so badly broken. And, you know, they're going after prevailing wage. You're going after collective bargaining rights. You're going after all of the things that now are happening to you here. And I think there's some cautionary tales in this, because when they do these things, it's almost impossible to get them undone.
Anytime soon. Well, you mentioned you're going to Wisconsin next week. I mean, 2011, that's when they lost their collective bargaining rights, public employees. And I was working for AFSCME at the time, so I spent a lot of time there. And then when it came up here, people, oh, that won't happen. Yeah. Not one Republican ever campaigned on it or ever mentioned it, but when they took control of the legislature in 2017, that was their first act, was to strip public employees of almost all of their collective bargaining rights.
No, I was there. We were sleeping on the floor of the Capitol for 11 days back in the frigid cold of February, and I remember going to Wisconsin because the news media was saying, oh, there's violence and there's going to be, you know, this chaos. And I'll tell you, you know, I've been on a picket line or two in my lifetime. I was, you know, looking forward to, you know, seeing some, you know, some spirited discussions.
Yeah.
And we get to Wisconsin, we pull into Madison, and I start walking towards the Capitol, and I'm greeted by a woman who's about 98 years old, I think she said she was, sitting in a wheelchair, handing out sweet potatoes.
Okay.
And I'm going, this is not quite what I was expecting. And we went to the next, you know, couple blocks down. There was the machinists who were handing out bratwurst. And, you know, there was a community event. The community was coming together saying, no, you can't do this to us. Now, they did it anyway, like thieves in the night, in the middle of the night at 2 a.m. But it was still this opportunity to bring the community together to demand. And I think we still need to be doing these things.
Absolutely. We gotta have fun, I think, is part of it, but we've also gotta keep people involved, which sometimes involves having fun or give gifts or something.
Yeah. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Steve Siegel. He's the vice president of the South Central Iowa Federation of Labor. You're talking about what's going on here in the city of Ottumwa and South Central Iowa. You know, I'm looking in the moment that we're in, and again, I come back to this, keep coming back to the reality that Republicans hate working people and their policies show this. Now, I talk to a lot of people who go, look, the Democrats haven't always been our friends. And I think you have to admit that. I'm harder on Democrats than I am on Republicans because I go, look, I know they hate me. I know they hate working people. I know their policies are going to be pointed at punishing working people. But I think we do have to admit the failures of the Democrats over the years to stand up and fight for working people and not do that to bash them, but do them to educate them so that they do stand up and they do fight. And I look at this administration. They are doing some things that I'm okay with, that I want to see more of: investing in infrastructure, reshoring manufacturing, and talking about strengthening unions.
Yeah, I think Biden's done a better job of that than our last several Democratic presidents. Like, you were talking about Obama, who, yeah, I liked Obama, but when Wisconsin went down, he never went.
Nope, no comfortable shoes. Remember during the campaign? You know, he said, I'm going
to
get my comfortable shoes and I'm going to walk the picket lines. Well, all during that time, I was going, hey, I've got comfortable shoes for you.
No, he didn't come. And they didn't really pass any labor legislation.
They didn't pass any labor legislation. And no, I go back to, you know, you go back to Carter, we were told they were going to undo Taft-Hartley. You go to Clinton, they were going to get strike replacement. Obama told me personally twice something better than the Employee Free Choice Act, and workers got nothing. So this frame that they're not doing anything for working people keeps getting saddled on them because they're not. I mean, when they have power and control.
But in fairness, both Clinton and Obama only had their own party majorities the first 2 years, and then they were saddled as Republican congressman.
I get that. But for me, the first club out of the box should have been past workers' rights.
That's right.
This is the stuff that unites us. So this is it's the same thing with the infrastructure bill. Pass the stuff that unites us. Get to that stuff first. Get it done. Get it up, down. We can do things quickly. We've seen that. And this is where I think, you know, Democrats have to be able to take that, learn how to drive the steamroller, so to speak.
No, I agree. And in Iowa here, we had a governor. Well, we had the trifecta. We had the Democrats had the House, Senate, and governor in 2006, did nothing for labor. Consequently, the next time our Chet Culver ran, he got beat. And we had really worked to get people to support him,
yep.
And then he didn't do anything.
So the simple message here is, do the work. When you have the keys to the steamroller, drive it. Get your agenda passed, and support workers' rights. Help workers. Because look, we're being told in this moment, you know, we're supposed to be, you know, fighting for all of these other issues. And look, you want to be on the right side of all of those fringe issues. For me, it's that central issue that binds all of us. It's those workers' rights issues. That's where you spend the most of your time. Yeah, you want to be right on same-sex marriage. You want to be right on transgender issues. You want to be on the right side of freedom and liberty and all of that, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. But it's the kitchen table economic stuff that I think really matters. The James Carville, it's the economy, stupid.
Oh, I agree, Rick. I mean, and those affect everyone. Some of the other issues don't affect everyone. They're important. But workers' rights and workers' incomes, and that tells the story for everybody. And I think that certainly the Democrats have been more supportive than the Republicans on those issues, but they have disappointed us at times.
No, you're absolutely right. But again, this is why we need working people to step forward, run for office. Well, you ran for office, right?
Oh, yeah. I actually won several times.
Look at that. See, we need more you. How do we get more you?
I don't know. Hopefully we don't have quite that, but but no, yeah, I mean, we got to have our friends and our own members preferably running for office. And locally here, both of our legislative candidates are former or current or former union members, so step in the right direction. I'm cautiously optimistic for both of them. It'd be great, but
yeah, the message there, vote for your union brothers and sisters.
Absolutely.
To be in office.
Absolutely.
And again, this is what we need to be doing. But, Steve, I appreciate you taking a little time for us, sharing your thoughts.
Thank you. And I appreciate you guys coming here. We don't get a lot of visitors from the media here in Ottumwa.
But we've
enjoyed glad to have you.
We've enjoyed our time here. And thank you for the work that you've done.
Thank you, Rick.
Thanks so much, Steve Siegel. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick, at therickSmithShow.com. Tell us what you think as we continue on our Working Class Heroes radio tour. Make sure you check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, podcast, it's always there, always available. You can get that at therickSmithShow.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2001. That was the day that Thomas Morris Jr. died from breathing in anthrax. A week earlier, he had been exposed to the deadly poison when an envelope containing the powdery substance was opened at the mail distribution center where he worked. Thomas Morris was a member of the American Postal Workers Union. His union brother, Joseph Kersine, died 2 days later. Both men worked at the U.S. Postal Service Brentwood Processing and Distribution Center in Washington, D.C. The poisoned letters were addressed to Senators Tom Daschle and Patrick Leahy. More postal workers at a distribution center in New Jersey also fell ill from exposure to anthrax poisoned mail. In total, 22 people were sickened by anthrax that fall from letters addressed to politicians and news outlets. In addition to those injured, 5 people died, including a 7-month-old infant who was visiting NBC News in New York York City with his mother who worked there. Coming the month after the September 11th attacks, the anthrax poisoning sent another wave of fear of terrorism throughout the United States. The Brentwood Distribution Center was closed down for decontamination until December 2003. When it reopened, the facility was renamed for the two fallen postal workers. The next year, Senator Joe Lieberman gave an address to the APWU. He said, quote, "The postal workers who were exposed to anthrax and still got the mail out and kept our system running. They are proud union members. I know I'll never forget that, and America won't forget that. All of you at the APWU deserve our respect and our support." One person suspected of the poisonings committed suicide, and the case was closed. No one was ever convicted of the crimes. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you can't talk about Ottumwa, Iowa without talking about the John Deere strike that just happened here. And, you know, we spoke with a couple of people who were on that strike. And, you know, when you've got Ottumwa is about a town of about 25,000. And the Ottumwa plant, which has been, as I understand, in operation since 1911 or something like that. But there's 1,000 workers at this Ottumwa plant that's been there in operation since, like I said, I think 1911. And the folks here are like, look, this it's an institution. It's part of the community. And this idea that, well, and look, we got to drive by it. It's an enormous place. And the machinery that you see coming out of that place, you know, and the pride of the workers that build this stuff is really incredible. Now, you know, what they were saying is, look, you know, we earned. And this is what I love about the folks, and especially here, because I've talked about this extensively, this idea that people say, well, you know, we deserve a raise, or, you know, we're entitled to this. You don't deserve or entitled to any. You earned it. And that's what these folks are saying. Look, we earned this. We busted our you know what to make this company profitable. And look, the company was overwhelmingly profitable. This is the thing that gets me. We see these companies who are making so much money off the backs of the workers, and then not wanting to share it. Now, we talked with someone who's, you know, look, you know, I think fourth generation a worker in this plant. And the story that they tell is, look, it's Americana. It's what we talk about all the time. Gives people the opportunity to work hard, play by the rules, and yes, get ahead. You know, I met a guy. This is one of those weird kind of stories. When we were getting ready to go over to the UAW hall to start our day and to start recording and to have, you know, Steve drive us around and show us things. You know, we stayed at a campground because we got this giant RV and we got to park it somewhere. So we decided we're going to stay at this campground in Ottumwa. It's right in the heart of town. Beautiful place right up against the park. And we had the whole place to ourselves, basically, because there's virtually nobody else there because it's cold. But, you know, you go into the showers and there was a guy there. And, you know, I didn't say anything. I just walked by him and he goes, "Hey, how are you?" Because people in Iowa are really friendly. And I said, good. You know, we started talking about, you know, what we're doing there and all of this. And I said, you know, we're doing this little radio gig and we're going around talking about this. He goes, "Hey, you know, I worked at John Deere in Waterloo." And I said, "Oh, yeah, you know, tell me about it." And he goes, "Well, I retired, you know, 15 years ago." And I go, "But you're not that old." He goes, "Yeah, I retired at 55 and retired with a full pension at 55, did his 30 some odd years. And here's the kicker. This is the part that got me. I'm like, so you retired with a pension. What'd you do for healthcare?" "Oh, well, you know, it was in our contract. We negotiated retiree healthcare. And, you know, it's something that we used to have. We used to have it. And corporate America has taken it away at every opportunity." And again, it's one of these things where you have this conversation. This guy, look, he worked hard. He said, "Look, I busted my butt for that company for 30 some odd years. I went in every day. I worked hard, made them a quality product. I'm proud of the work that I did. But you know what? There's more to life." He goes, "Look, my body's beaten up. You know, I've got aches and pains still to this day. But you know what? I worked hard." and I earned this retirement. And him and his wife, they go around and, you know, they were looking for a new place to live. They're living their dream. And it comes back to this thought that I have of, you know, we don't live to work. We work to live. We don't work to live. We live to work. And this guy, you know, is the epitome of that. He spent his years. He busted his behind. He did all the work, did what he was supposed to do. And now he's able to retire. And as we were talking, he was going, look, I feel sorry for my kids and my grandkids because they're not going to know what I have. They're not going to be able to do the kind of things that my wife and I have been able to do. They're not going to be able to retire. They're not going to have the same opportunities that I had. And he said, look, it's because of the union. You know, reality, you know, I wouldn't have what I have if it weren't for the union fighting for this. Now he goes, look, you know, I didn't vote for any contract because I thought they were all concessionary. But the fact that we had the opportunity, the fact that we had the ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, to fight to maintain retiree health care, and we did it while I was there, he said, that's a sense of pride for me. And, you know, this was the message. I go, look, if only I could bottle you and share this story with everyone, because it's really an important story and one that every working person should aspire to get to. Just my thought. Want to hear yours? Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is the best of The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1949. That was the day Americans awoke to fears the nationwide steel strike would spread rapidly to include key fabrication plants. 500,000 steel workers had joined 400,000 coal miners on strike the morning before. The miners resolved to defend their $100 a month pension, instituting what John L. Lewis called the No Day Work Week, emboldened the steel workers to walk out of the mills. Within 24 hours, 96% of all steel production in the country was completely shut down. United Steelworker contracts were due to expire on the 15th, but the writing was on the wall. The mill owners decried anything close to mine pensions as nothing short of socialistic and refused to budge in negotiations. United Steelworkers President Phil Murray thundered that those companies that failed to agree to demands for non-contributory pensions and insurance would be shut down. But militants warned that President Truman's fact-finding board had already watered down strike demands. The president's board had been established to put off two previous strike deadlines. The guidelines it issued only encouraged steel magnates to stand tough against United Steelworker demands. These included a 30-cent raise plus increased company insurance and pension contributions. Now, it had become a defensive struggle over whether steelworkers would have to begin contributing to health and pension plans through wage cuts. By the time steelworkers ended their strike 42 days later, they had won the $100 a month pension minus what they would receive from Social Security, and they had to begin contributing to a health insurance plan with no wage increase at all. Still, workers celebrated that they had successfully defended the United Steelworkers against the all-out union busting drive.
My newspaper died. Well, technically it still appears, but it has no life, no news, and barely a pulse. It's a mere semblance of a real paper, one of the hundreds of local journalism zombies staggering along in cities and towns that had long relied on them. Each one has a bare number of subscribers keeping it going, mostly longtime readers like me, clinging to a memory of what used to be and a flickering hope that surely the thing won't get worse. Then it does. Our papers are getting worse at a time we desperately need them to get better because they are no longer mediums of journalism, civic purpose, and local identity. Rather, they've been reduced to little more than profit siphons, steadily piping local money to a handful of distant high-finance syndicates that have bought out our hometown journals. My daily, the Austin American Statesman, was swallowed up in 2019 by the nationwide Gannett chain, becoming one of more than 1,000 local papers Gannett presently mass-produces under its corporate banner, the USA Today Network. But even that reference is a deception, for the publication doesn't confide to readers that it's actually a product of SoftBank Group, a multi-billion-dollar Japanese financial consortium that owns and controls Gannett. SoftBank has no interest in Austin as a place, a community, or even as a newspaper market. Nor does it care one whit about advancing the principles of journalism. It's in the profit business, extracting maximum short-term payouts from the properties it owns. This has rapidly become the standard business model for American newspapering. Today, more than half of all daily papers in America are in the grip of just 10 of these money syndicates. This is Jim Hightower saying, that's why our local papers are dying. It's not a failure of journalism, but of absentee corporate owners plundering journalism.
You're listening to the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, spending a little time here in Ottumwa, Iowa. As I've been saying, you know, this is such a beautiful place, but the history, the labor history, this is what has grabbed my attention. If you remember, you know, we've talked about this in the past. This is kind of the home of the Hormel strike back in the 80s. Some of the major attacks that came afterwards, you know, this was a moment. This was an important moment in labor history, and here to share some thoughts on that history, I've asked John McCurley to come talk with us. John McCurley is a labor historian at the University of Iowa's Labor Center. You can check out their website, laborcenter.uiowa.edu. We'll get links out on social media. How you can check that out. John McCurley, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
So, I go back to, coming here and, remembering the history of the Hormel strike and thinking about all of the aftermath that came out of it. This is kind of an important place for labor, isn't it?
It's a very important place for labor, and especially here in the state of Iowa, well, and really in the whole Midwest. So Ottumwa has this rich labor history, stretches back to the 19th century. It was in the coal country in Iowa, which we forget that there was a coal country, right? But John L. Lewis comes out of that area eventually before he goes to Illinois and kind of makes his name. And then Ottumwa becomes a meatpacking center in the late 19th century and is one with the Morrell family up until the early 1970s. And so this is the bit of history that you really need to know that frames the Hormel strike, because Morrell closes their plant in 1973 in Ottumwa, and it's a tremendous shock to the community, right? It's a good way of thinking about the ways in which the 1970s, some of the things that are going to sort of come home to roost in terms of the sort of new wave of anti-labor attacks by employers really start in the 1970s. But it's unclear exactly sort of what's going to happen, right? So it's disorienting in many ways. And so one of those disorienting acts is the closing of Morrell's in 73. Hormel as they say locally, or in Austin, demolishes the old Morrell factory, builds a new one, 1976, hires a whole new group of people, mostly young workers. There's a lot of these old UPWA veterans who had built this really powerful packing house worker union in the city, local one, in fact. Some of them don't get rehired, right, because Hormel is not interested in that. But that said, these workers build a pretty powerful union over the next several years into the early 1980s there in Ottumwa. They're organized through Local 431, what is now, again, like after 1979, UFCW Local 431, that is headquartered out of Davenport in the Quad Cities, right there on the border between Iowa and Illinois.
Right, and that's important because of what's coming down the road.
Right. So they're part of this amalgamated local, right? So what happened, the main story, right, of course, takes place in Austin, right, which is this old meatpacking center. There in the 70s, the old P9, again, the P designating a packing house worker local, right, because the packing house workers had gone into the amalgamated meat cutters, which then went into the UFCW, but they carried with them this legacy in their numbers of the P. So packing house worker, P9 local, is facing, just like all these other locals in the chain, pressure increasingly from Hormel in order to take concessions, right, in the 80s. And so here's one of the things that comes out of the oral histories that I work on here at the University of Iowa Labor Center, is that at least in the memory of a lot of these workers, both in Austin and in Ottumwa, there's this sense that Hormel bought the Ottumwa plant, built that plant precisely because they had intended to whipsaw Ottumwa against Austin. Again, I can't prove that, but that's the thing that people, that's part of the memory of the folklore of this, because of what happens next, which is essentially that, where Hormel, in order to get leverage on other parts of the chain, gets concessions in the Ottumwa plant first. Right. And again, remember, right, you know, this is a community that had been through a trauma in the early 70s, right? They really remembered the pain of this major employer disappearing, right?
Right.
And so, yeah, that and then that in the midst of the 80s, the other traumas of the 80s, you know, helps them win these concessions. So then what happens is Hormel takes those concessions back to Austin, but the workers there organize an anti-concessionary movement within their local. And that ultimately is what precipitates the strike, right? And so you know, what those workers in Austin begin to do is to try to build other support within the chain. And one of the key places where they find that support ultimately is in Ottumwa. There's a longstanding historical connection between Ottumwa and Austin. Frank Ellis, if you've ever heard of him, one of these famous Midwestern meatpacking workers, he was an old Wobbly who organized the Austin workers, organized all over the Midwest. He had also been down in Ottumwa. I've been told that there was a portrait of Frank Ellis hanging in the hall, the old 431 hall, at one point. It was that connection was that strong. And so, you know, even though the concessions had started in Ottumwa, you know, pretty quickly those Ottumwa workers decided that they were going to throw their lot in with Austin. And here's the thing that I think you were alluding to just a minute ago, which is that put them at odds with the leadership of their local 431 in Davenport, which sided with the international, which had essentially decided that the conditions at the time were so bad that there was a kind of, from the international's point of view, it was better to take the concessions and live to fight another day than to go up against this behemoth in the midst of the 80s and be crushed and maybe harm the international in the process.
Right. And now you look at this, and this is one of those moments where you look at the lesson of the past. It's only gotten that much worse. These companies have gotten that much bigger and have that much more power and have the ability to crush these organizing campaigns and crush these unions. And our labor laws have gotten so broken and so ossified that sadly, you know, workers are kind of, you know, behind the eight ball to begin with. Even though right now we are seeing some activity, you know, these losses still, as you point out, people remember the pain and the suffering and the struggling, even that far back. And, you know, look, this happened in 1985, 86. This is a while ago, but the people here that I talk to, they still remember it.
Yeah, absolutely. And in part, they remember because of what happened next in the story, which is that so the Ottumwa workers, in their contract, there was language that supported their ability to honor picket lines. And so when Austin workers said, you know, sent roving pickets down, they sent them other places, but Ottumwa was the most successful, sent them down here, and the workers overwhelmingly honored them. But then the company fired them all, virtually all of them. So this is like 500 people, roughly 500 people. And, you know, both the production, and actually this is something that's oftentimes forgotten, is that the local there had organized as well many of the clerical staff. And so, you know, they fired everybody who honored the picket lines. Immediately, the workers in Ottumwa began to fight that in court. But of course, you know, they had to immediately also contend with the fact that they'd all been fired.
All right.
So, you know, this, you know, it was both an incredible act of solidarity on the part of Atomo workers, but it, and it drew them closer to the strike. But it was also, as I say, you know, as you were saying, you know, again, another kind of trauma where people had to suddenly contend with being put out of work unexpectedly.
So let me ask you this, Jonathan, because, you know, again, you see what this company did, and we know the history of it and what they got away with. How much of this was, you know, the Reagan era, you know, firing of the Patco workers? Because I say that was kind of the shot heard across the boardroom to empower these companies to really take what they were trying to do in the 70s to that next level. And this Hormel strike, along with Phelps Dodge and some of the others, you know, they really put their foot on the necks of working people during this period.
I think it's a really good example of that extra layer of power, right? You know, that for a long time, I think that they, you know, these corporate leaders, you know, they sort of looked over their shoulder and still thought that perhaps there were some of these kind of New Deal era guardrails in place. And I think, as you say, that, you know, the firing of the Patco workers did become this kind of shot heard around the boardrooms, where they recognized that those guardrails were no longer there, and that they had the leverage in order to do what they wanted to do, which, you know, for my money, my professional opinion is that that there was never really much of a detente, that these corporate leaders never really, in many ways, accustomed themselves to unions and were always, for the most part, looking for opportunities to rid themselves of the need to negotiate with their workers, and this becomes a powerful opportunity for them.
Yeah, you're listening to the Rick Smith Show with John McCurley. John's a labor historian at the University of Iowa Labor Center. If you want to check out the work they do, laborcenter.uiowa.edu. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at that. Now, John, you know, we're in this interesting time because, you know, labor's approval ratings at an all-time high. Young people are coming back to it. You know, these kind of things are forgotten. If anyone, you know, it's just old guys like me who remember these things. The message going forward, are there lessons in this to be taken forward? Are there things that, you know, that should be shared? I'm curious, you know, given the situation we're in now, what do you take from that era moving forward?
What I take hope from is that, you know, that as much power as was thrown at workers, like in places like Atumwa or any of these kind of small, medium-sized cities, especially, that have been so hollowed out by neoliberalism over the last several decades, is that you know, there are a lot of union members still here of many generations fighting together to improve their communities, right? That regardless of the incredible power that these employers and the money that they have available to them have thrown at these places, they have not destroyed the labor movement. You know, it may not be the kind of places that oftentimes get coverage, and sometimes it's forgotten about or ignored, the continued presence of labor, but it is still here, and the heartbeat of it continues. And, you know, you saw it, say, for example, in the incredible solidarity around the recent John Deere strike, right? You know, it's an example of the fact that the labor is still here, still fighting every day, and you know, that's what I take hope from.
No, and then, you know, the strength that we see on the Ingredion picket line in Cedar Rapids, and, you know, also the Case New Holland strike over in Burlington. There's a, you know, this is a no rights at work state, and you can't forget that Iowa has been a no rights at work state for a very long time. And yet you still have this kind of power that workers, you know, are able to join together. Not at the levels that I'm used to growing up in Ohio or living in Pennsylvania, but still there are strong union ties in these communities.
Well, and one of the things that oftentimes gets the, I mean, it is obviously it's quite true, right? We've been a right to work state almost since Taft Hartley, right? 1947. There are a lot of locals, you know, particularly in the private sector in manufacturing. Some of them have almost 100% density, right? So, like a local that I'm working with right now, one of these John Deere locals, 450 out of Ankeny, they have almost 100% density, right? So it's an example of how in certain contexts, even in a right to work state, there are incredibly powerful locals that have been able to build really strong contracts. I mean, increasingly, they are really siloed, right? Like in the old days, they would have like three or four of those in a community, and they would be able to draw on that power locally in order to project it in ways that are really difficult now. But those places still exist even in Iowa.
No, and this is where I keep coming back to, you know, the lesson of Ottumwa and the people that I talk to here is just what you just said. There were multiple factories, multiple places where unions were strong, and you had these communities that were union communities. Even the people who weren't working the jobs and in the unions were strong supporters of those workers having rights to collective bargain, to rights to better wages, hours, and conditions, because they knew it trickled down to everyone else. And it was a community thing. And this is where my mind keeps coming back to, and why I think places like Ottumwa are so important to look at, because this model has to be replicated, and we have to return to an era where we start thinking about each other, you know, like much more like my grandparents' generation did, who built the most prosperous working class in the history of civilization by doing the hard work that you see in these places.
Yes. And the thing that I think is particularly, I think it's true it's true in lots of places around the country, but particularly here in Iowa, right, where we don't have a Chicago, we don't have a Minneapolis, we don't have a Toledo, or we are a state of small cities in many ways, right? And those small cities have been particularly hurt by deindustrialization, right? Where you might have a, you know, you, the local economy might have been, a couple of local factories that were unionized, maybe a small college, in some cases unionized actually at one point, community college, local school system, and then systematically those feet of the stool have been kicked out, and that's been crippling to many of these communities. But as I say, there continues to be these living labor movements in these places that continue to struggle, and I really think that if we're gonna save democracy in this country, it's going to be through the labor movement, and it's going to be through sustaining the labor movement in these small cities and communities where, you know, they're the heart of democracy.
No, I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, you know, the tour that we're doing, this Working Class Heroes radio tour, the premise started right there. And I tell the story all the time, John, that, you know, on election night 2020, I wasn't watching election results. I was leading a strike of 55 warehouse workers who, you know, three quarters of them that afternoon voted for Donald Trump. But in that moment, on that picket line, and they were, you know, a microcosm of America, you know, white, black, male, female, gay, straight, they were all of that. They were united in what I say is the right fight, the righteous fight. It's not which hat you bought, the red or the blue or the right or the left. It was up, down. They were looking up at this huge corporation who was making billions of dollars of profits while telling them, no, we can't pay your health care. No, we can't give you a raise. No, we can't make your lives better. And they said, no, we're going to stick together and we're going to move forward. And in that, they were all together in this country, as divided as we are told we are. They were as diverse as their political backgrounds. They were all united in that one struggle. And I think you're right, and I've been saying it as well. This is how we reunite, re-energize, and revive this country.
Yeah, I can't say anything better than that.
So I guess last line of questioning I've got for you then, because you know we're in this, obviously in this moment. Are there lessons going forward? And I know I asked this before, because there are so many people who don't know what you do at the Labor Center there at the University of Iowa. I get people all the time who listen to our Labor History in Two segments, and they say, wow, I didn't know that. You know, how do I find more information? How do we educate our children? There's so much thirst and want for you know, what our labor history has been. Are there any lessons in what we've been talking about for people moving forward and how we move and organize and do the things that need to be done in the future?
Yeah, there's a lot. I mean, I'll just turn this, you know, specifically to in the direction of labor education. And so, you know, what the labor center where I work, you know, primarily is staffed with labor educators. And what they do is they go out and they provide all sorts of education needs to popular education needs to workers all around the state. In fact, they're the only institution in the in what's our Regents system. So that's the state university system here in Iowa that that is specifically directed at worker education. And they've been doing that for 70 years. Unfortunately, there was a turn that pulled away state funding from that single center that's directed at worker education. And so we continue here in Iowa to fight to preserve the demanded for again and again right of workers to have some part of their state university system providing to them the access to the education that they need to preserve their rights at work, right? And so, you know, and those sorts of centers like